here. I don't know the matter. Okay, let me call to order the first infrastructure. Are we got the thing on? Okay.
Yes.
The first infrastructure committee meeting of the city of San Ramon for February 9th, 2018. Public comment? Anybody? Public comment? Okay. New business, because we don't have any old business. 3.1.
You want to approve the minutes first of the last meeting?
It's not on the list.
All right, discussion of allocation of funds for a citywide drainage and infrastructure repairs project. And that is, Maria and Robin.
Well, actually, I'd like to take this opportunity to reintroduce Shane Shaw over there, and he's going to take it away.
Okay.
And give you a brief report on this one.
Okay.
Okay, so many people here, most of you might already know that we have the CIP 5548, that is the citywide drainage and infrastructure repair project. So over the years, we have a lot of different funding sources, and for now, mainly it's from our development, which gives us the creek mitigation fund and drainage and mitigation funds. So we have some balance in these two funds for this, and also we have some leftover balance in the CIP projects. And the main thing that we want to do right now is that there are a few erosion that happened due to all the storms with all the large rainfall last winter that created a lot of these erosions that we would like to repair. And a lot of these repairs that can be reimbursed by FEMA and Cal OES. And also, we would like to do a citywide drainage infrastructure inventory. And so all of these projects add up to about $580,000 that we currently prioritized. And so to fund all these projects, we would like to allocate our current balance in the creek mitigation fund of about $21,000, drainage mitigation funds of $182,000, and also from the infrastructure maintenance fund of $346,000. And so our plan is that in the next 2 years, we should be able to get reimbursement from FEMA and Cal OES. And also we would keep getting the creek mitigation fund and drainage mitigation fund from developers. So we should be able to repay these $346,000 of construction mitigation funds.
Okay, in the report it says that an additional $340,000 is anticipated to be collected from the two funds in the next two fiscal years. So we'll actually end up with 2 years from now, if we get the FEMA reimbursement, we'll actually end up with a balance of almost $300,000 in those two funds. Is that correct?
And when you add it all together?
Yeah, because we're going to get $300,000 from FEMA, and it says here in paragraph 2 and page 3 that there's $340,000 of anticipated funds incoming.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we should end up with a balance in the two funds then of about $300,000 at the end of 2 years.
Well, it is anticipated that we'd be paying back the infrastructure maintenance fund, so yeah, we would pay back.
But that's what I'm saying. Yeah. Those two funds would end up with a balance of about $300,000.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Through the payback reimbursement of the FEMA. Okay.
Yes.
And then this other list on page 5. A, Q, Q, B, and zero projects. That's another $700,000 worth of
mm-hmm.
projects. But those are, looks like they're scheduled out 18, 19, and 20. Are there any of those that are urgent or in danger of failure, or what's your opinion on those?
Since we completed this report, actually, we just got a report back on a scour feature that is on Canyon Road, and that is potentially undermining a mechanically stabilized earth wall. So a mechanically stabilized earth wall is a wall that is built with concrete facing and steel reinforcing fabric that runs back from that facing, and the rest of the backfill is all made out of, in this case, essentially a pea gravel-like material. So if that scour continues, it could undermine that backfill material, which can then ravel out from under the wall. So that's a potentially urgent situation because it could result in a sinkhole appearing with relatively little warning right in the middle of Cocaine Road.
Okay. Is that the Q on this list?
Yes, that's Q.
Okay.
But these unfunded below are K, Q, and B and O. Are those unfunded?
Those are essentially unfunded. There will be some money that comes in the following few years, which maybe we either borrow against or maybe we change our priorities a little bit in order to make sure that we're dealing with that Crow-Canyon Wall situation. But we have not yet received enough information to be able to put a reliable price tag on that repair.
This has nothing to do with the, this on the Deerwood side, which won't impact the Crow-Canyon widening. Is that correct?
That's correct. Okay. It's not related to that.
Is there nearby utilities that are in jeopardy? Water, sewer?
Yeah, there likely would be under that road running through the landfill.
Okay. Well, I'd like to get a report to council as soon as you can about the urgency for doing that.
So the current plan and the item that's going to be before council was to get these allocations so that we move as much money as possible out of the drainage and creek mitigation fund and then borrow money from the infrastructure fund so as to be able to move forward with the identified items. But if we were to have to reprioritize, we might move money out from the drainage and infrastructure study or minor repairs or other items to make sure we can go in a timely fashion while reassessing what our future cash flow will be to see maybe it postpones the repayment of those monies or whatever else we need to do. But what I'd like to do is just move forward with the staff report as written so we can get going, and then as soon as we get money, report back to council as to what the updated situation on that wall is.
Okay. Good. I recommend we forward this to the council for approval.
Sounds good.
As written, and then please get back to us as soon as you have something to report on that Crow Canyon Wall Road, MSC Wall.
Okay, so since this is our first meeting and since we all love pavement, I thought it was appropriate to do this presentation, and we have quite a few items that we want to go through and make sure we're
coming through the window and nailing me right in the eye. Oh, that's much better.
So we want to start off, make sure we're all on the same page and you understand the problem as we're seeing it and what our proposed solutions are. So first, let me introduce the team. I think you all know me, but you probably know me more as GAD and drainage things. Before I came to the city of San Ramon, I did a lot of work in the private sector. And a lot of that included pavement work. Pavement work is kind of an integral part of geotechnical engineering. So I've done a lot of pavements for everything from parking lots, streets, I-80, Port of Oakland, things out on SFO's acres and taxiways, special pavements. I've also done analysis and design rehabilitation of asphalt and concrete pavements and ground improvement projects that often go along with that, things like what we did on Alcosta Boulevard. Daniel Chavarria, you may remember, he's our new senior engineer. He's the new Mustafa. His experience is also private public sector. He comes to us from San Francisco, where he helped work on their $6 million pavement management projects. He also worked at the City of Orinda on their pavement management project. Notice there's a nice big dollar number there. From
Orinda, $8 million a year? Good
they
Lord.
Had bonds and tax.
Wow.
He's also an ADA accessibility expert, which is important because there are a lot of ADA issues that crop up along with our pavement. And as mentioned, he's done work with projects that are funded by general obligation bonds. Susie, sitting next to me, also public and private experience. She's done a lot of work doing pavement distress evaluation and determining those PCI numbers that you see. She's worked for various cities and counties in the Bay Area doing those PCAP projects that lead us to our discussions of today. She's a street saver expert, and she's also been working on our pavement projects in San Ramon. And next to her is Joe Reary. He's with Pavement Engineering, Inc. Well, as their name says, that's what they do. That's what he does. 30-plus years of pavement management and rehabilitation experience, hundreds of clients, 75 employees, and thousands of projects. So we're glad to have his...
Are you the principal or the
one
CEO?
Of them.
Or?
Yes, one of them. There's two of us.
Okay.
So what we want to do is briefly go over some of the fundamentals of pavement, talk about what our current PCI is and what our current condition is, and define a strategy of how to deal with our current and future pavement challenges. I'm going to hand it over to Susie, Pavement 101.
Well, try not to turn it on. So, Susie. So just to introduce you a little bit to the pavement design, we design it for the vehicle loads. We also design it for the soils beneath, so there's different types of soils, different types of pavement. And for the pavement deterioration, there's a lot of environmental ways that it deteriorates. There's also the fatigue from the vehicles that ride on the pavement, which you're probably familiar with. But the environmental is really the sun and the water, so the UV rays that break up the pavement. So the UV rays will take and break up and break down the asphalt emulsion, which will start in with the cracks, and when you get your rain and your water, and it feeds its way down, it will break up the pavement and make it break apart, basically.
So even with no load, it
Sorry?
Will... Even with no load,
it
will look like hell within 20-something years, 10 years, whatever, something.
Yeah, pretty much. You don't even need a load on it. And also, sometimes there's springs underneath that you aren't aware of, or there's changes with development, and the underlying soil will be undermined.
So this is obviously AC you're talking about.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And then the loads that we deal with, so basically... 3/4-ton trucks or SUVs, each one of these, like the two-axle trucks, there's 442 of these 3/4-ton trucks equals the two-axle truck. So when you get down to your garbage trucks, that's the loads that are on your residential pavements,
okay.
You know, picking up truck stops.
So a vehicle unit is one SUV.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Exactly. Just want you to have that. Now we go on to the pavement preservation principle. So basically, how do we maintain our pavement? Up here we have what we call is the PCI to years. So it's the condition of your pavement 2 years and the environmental effects, the loads. So in the middle is your typical. This would be the typical. This is extreme. So maybe a county road that you all of a sudden put some heavy loads on. It wasn't designed for it. It breaks up rather fast. And then over here would be something that doesn't have, you know, let's say garbage trucks on it or such. So really light load. But this is the typical curve that we see. So how we evaluate the visual on the pavement sections is called Pavement Condition Index. So the PCI, everybody knows PCI. The U.S. Army Corps came up with this way of rating it. So it's a visual rating. It goes from
zero. That's not a plus with me, by the way.
What are you?
I'm a Navy engineer.
Same with my dad. I wasn't going to mention it.
We've had to take what they've done and improve it on. Yeah.
Yeah. Improve on it. There we go. Yeah.
Yeah. It started there.
So it goes from 0 to 100, 100 being a new pavement and 0 being gravel, basically, if that gives you some sort of idea. It's a great tool to use. So what we do is we need some...
Is there any... I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Is there any alternative that is out there that is used besides PCI, or is that just the standard and nobody has any...
This is a standard. It's the best standard that we've had over the years. It goes across the country, across...
empty.
Several countries, not just
there. There are different tools that are used when you're actually getting into the design. This is used as a planning and budgeting tool, as opposed to a design tool. So from that perspective, yes, you do different things when you're getting ready to design.
We have to report to MTC based upon PCI. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So ultimately, we have to come up with a PCI for everything.
Yes.
Even if we use other techniques for other purposes.
That is correct. It's in our best interest to keep it that way. Otherwise, we'll have to basically translate what we do to their terms.
Okay.
So the Metropolitan Transportation Committee, MTC, they back Street Saver. So Street Saver is their baby. And that's why we use Street Saver. It's a database. So basically, you could use any database, but you want to use the one that MTC, and so we can talk to you, send information back and forth.
And that's how you get grants.
So. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So you want to use it. And we break it up into sections. So it's not just streets. We have over 1,400 sections. So we can go block to block. You could split a street. Sometimes in new developments or not a new development, you may reconstruct an area. And you want to break it out because maybe it's, you know, maybe it's a mile long. So you want to break it out because there's a section that's 700. You don't want one to be 70 and one to be 100, right? You want to separate these PCIs. But anyways, we have over 1,400 sections in our Street Saver database. Also in our database, we keep the different pavement maintenance costs so that we can come up with some sort of cost per street, or we can plan out for years ahead. But it's really just a tool to plan, to give us an idea of what's out there. But we go out and actually inspect the streets to see if they match what's going on. So now this is to break down how you get to those PCIs. So when you go out, you have to have some sort of way to come up with the number, right? So you don't want anything random. This is what everybody does. It's across the country. There's 7 distresses. Now Street Saver has broken out the weathering and the raveling into 2, so now there's 8 in our Street Saver database because they found that the weathering and the raveling, we get a better PCI if it's broken out separately than to group it together. So I don't know if you're familiar with the different distresses or...
Some of them.
Some of them? Okay. So we gave a few pictures. The weathering and the raveling in here is together, but the raveling would be more like if you saw gravel, loose gravel on the street, that would be a raveling. The weathering is more of when you just see a discolor. So the color kind of breaks down. So it starts off black and then it starts that gray color looking.
I told Maria when she had this job, I was walking a neighborhood out not far from where she lived, and the neighborhood was only, what, 3 years old at the time?
Yeah.
And it had started to turn gray. And a family that I was speaking to wanted to know how long it was going to be before the city was going to come back and make their street black again. I said, it'll be a few years.
And speaking to that, I mean, there is a thing called the fog seal, and you can come in, and it's kind of like a sunscreen.
Yes.
And you can spray it on, and it is worth doing to protect your new streets.
But a 3-year-old street was pristine. It was pristine. It showed none of this. It was just starting to turn gray.
It didn't match their car.
That's right.
Does the fog... You made a point about UV rays and this thing breaking down asphalt or pavement. Does that fog screen, or is there anything out there that you could spray on a pavement to like sunglasses and have UV protection.
It's the fog seals.
So that's the fog seal.
Yeah.
And then we'll go into our preventative maintenance procedure.
Okay. It's called a fog seal.
So these are the transverse tracks that I'm just going off the distresses. And these are the block crackings. This is just what they look like, and alligator crackings. I don't really want to get into the detail of it, but just to get you familiar with what we're looking for when given our visual PCIs and what our raters are looking at. This here is examples of the, I want to go back because this is important. So here, on the rating scale, it goes from 0 to 100. So you'll see that the poor, fair, and good, and that's what we wanted to give you an examples of these good, fair, poor, and the very poor. Just some examples of streets that you see, because you probably hear from residents. So this particular street, Christopher Way, this was given an 85. And I want you to realize that if somebody comes in and says, well, this street is an 83, that's not wrong. Different raters are going to give different points. They'll say it's a low, medium, or high on each. Like here is the longitudinal crack that goes down the middle. So that's a low. But another rater could come in and give it, say, a medium, and maybe it's not so long, come in about the same. But good is the important part here. It falls into that good range, and that calls out what type of preventative maintenance could go down. This is also a good street. So the difference in the street, this one's good too. It's a 79. This is your Broadmoor Drive. And these are just typical sections that are rated. So you don't pick out the really bad section. It's a typical section. These are an example of a fair, and you have a little bit more of the longitudinal. You'll see the weathering in here. And this one is Medina. I think that's how you pronounce the street. But it's a fair street, 59, and typical section has got alligatoring, and it's got low, medium, and high.
Something important here is that when we talk about fair, poor, that range, it's not that we're defining the type of treatment, basically, like pre-designing something. We're just using that as a tool to budget what we're going to spend. If you have over 1,400 sections, you want to put a number to each of them so you come up with a total, right? So this is not a design tool, it's just planning.
Also a poor street is Tangerine Street.
Yeah, this one suffers from buses very badly.
Yeah. And you can tell.
Yeah, part of the reason it still manages to be poor is all the patching that we've done. So actually, we mentioned the street again later, probably.
Yeah. So. Our favorite. So that's a good example. And then here we have another poor street, and you can see the difference. It's still poor. Visually, somebody might say, oh, this one's worse than the other, but it's still poor. It just falls into that range. And there's one example of a failed street. And I just want you to see, this one comes in at a 22. It has high weathering. I can see it from the photo, but I've been out on the street. It also has a lot of alligatoring, which is this area in here. It goes throughout the street. It's not just a small section of the street. It also has some block cracking, which doesn't come out of the...
So whereas we were looking at Medina that had some alligator, it isn't so extensive.
Exactly.
Okay, and this one is essentially throughout the entire street.
Exactly.
Okay.
So that's the difference in those. And then, we're going to give it to Joe.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here with you and talking about one of my favorite subjects, besides my grandchildren.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think Susie did a great job giving you the background of pavements, how they deteriorate, what happens to the pavements over time, and I think it's really perceptive that you figured out that even without loading conditions on there, the pavement is still going to deteriorate. And from a design point of view, you're trying to design it a pavement so that it fails at the same time from loading and from environmental distresses. And so that's what we're looking at. But then the trick is how do we keep the pavements in good shape. How do we get more out of it? How do we lengthen its life? And so that's the section that I get to talk about. When we talk about, in the pavement world, we call that pavement preservation. And in pavement preservation is just simply defined as doing the right treatment to the right pavement at the right time. And then we added to that, and that's what FHWA says, and then we added to that using the right materials. Because in California, we're getting a little bit challenged on some of our material sources and what's available to us. And so we want to be able to use the right materials. So keeping that in mind, I want to go into preserving pavements. So pavement preservation is all about timing. And Susie showed you the deterioration curve. This is what we can expect in terms of what, how a pavement is going to deteriorate over time. How it was constructed, how it's going to be used is going to determine if it's going to deteriorate faster or slower, but the curve is the same. Looks good for a long time, then falls off. And so there's different treatments that you apply at different points along the curve. Of course, your pavement condition index is very high over here. You're in the hundreds, or 100 over here, down to zero. And so it's a matter of trying to pick out the right treatment at the right time. So when the pavement is newer, you want to be able to seal up the cracks and keep the water out of it from getting into the underlying structures. We talked about different types of seals, fog seals. Slurry seal is a very common one. And what that is putting on that sunscreen over the top of the pavement and protecting it from the UV rays. It's not doing anything as far as protecting against the loading conditions. But remember, we can help preserve that pavement and stretch more life out of it if we can protect it from that. The binder is holding all the aggregate together, and that UV rays age harden that binder. It gets brittle, it gets harder, so that when heavy traffic does get on it, it breaks easier and faster. And so if we can keep the UV rays away, then it's gonna perform better and it's gonna perform longer. Then we get down in here to more aggressive maintenance treatments, and we're doing some cape seals and thin maintenance overlays. The city has been working with that and had some great success with that. It's a cheaper way, again, of addressing slight structural needs as well as preserving the pavement and protecting it from the ultraviolet rays. But when you get down into this part of the curve, you're dealing with overlays and reconstructs. Just to talk about the timing and make sure that we're all on the same page there, you're not going to take a brand new pavement and go and reconstruct it. That doesn't make any sense. Conversely, we don't want to take a pavement that's deteriorated way down here and go out and crack seal it. You're not helping it. That's not what the pavement needs, and you end up crack sealing everywhere when you're doing that. So it's all about timing, the right treatment to the right pavement at the right time.
And I assume these get more expensive as you go to the right.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that has to be factored in as we talk about preserving the pavements. So, and as long as I've been doing this, there's really only three ways that I can think of that you can manage your pavement system. So San Ramon has the whole pavement and all of the 1,400 sections, and now it's trying to figure out, okay, where do we spend the money to get the biggest bang for our buck? How do we go about doing that? And so there's three different ways that we go about it. One is, and you don't hear very much about this one, where people will say, I want to keep my good pavements good. And that's more of a top-down type management, thinking that the curve deteriorates over time. It's focusing on those upper pavements, and that's where you spend your limited money.
So you can stretch that curve out just a little bit further.
You can. Absolutely, you can. Then you get down into the second category, or the second management style, is worst first, or more of a bottom-up. So when you're looking at your pavements, you say, well, tell me what the worst one is, and then you spend your money on the worst one. And unfortunately, both the one and two are not sustainable over time. If we play it out in the long run, focusing on your best first pavements will mean that your pavements will deteriorate. You'll end up with a whole bunch of good ones and a whole bunch of bad ones is what will end up happening because you've ignored all those lower ones. The worst first pavement just means that every single street in the system is going to go down to failed mode before you end up spending your money. which has really negative consequences because now you're spending the most money that you can on trying to preserve your worst pavements and you're ignoring the best ones. So the best way to be able to manage your pavement is what I call critical point management. And that's it's easier to show than it is to describe. And so we put in this next slide over here. So here's our typical pavement deterioration curve coming down this way. And just as you identified, there's different costs for different PCI ranges, whether we're in good or poor or very poor or failed modes. Different costs are associated with these different regions. And if you remember back on the slide, there were different treatments that we were calling out along the way. Critical point management simply means that you're allowing you want to watch the pavements, and the pavement management system allows us to do that. So you're watching your pavements, and when they deteriorate to the point where they're going to drop into the next category, the next type of treatment, that's when you pick them up. And so you'll see that each of these are trigger points along the way, and so critical point management simply means that I'm going to take pavements in this area, and in this area, and in this area, and pick off pavements down here. And if you do that, now you have a sustainable system because you're addressing all of the pavements right at the right time. Does that make sense?
With the exception of the very last one, it's unacceptable to have, in my opinion, to have any streets below 25. And so your system has to account for the fact that occasionally you're going to be picking up some that have just barely dropped into that next category. Because we're not going to let it go another 2 or 3 years to let it turn to gravel.
No.
The citizens of San Ramon will not accept that.
Well, there's not only the public issues you deal with, but the health and safety as well.
The safety issues, exactly.
And so, yes.
Bicycles on those streets, police vehicles, fire vehicles.
Absolutely. And all of that has to be factored in to a pavement management system and trying to determine how you're going to spend your money and where you want to focus that money. But in my experience, the best way that you can approach it is using a critical point management style. That doesn't mean that every year that's what you follow. It might mean that your system is telling you something different and you need to be more of a best first, and then you also need to incorporate in sometimes some of your worst first. It just depends on your system. It's a very dynamic process.
Okay.
And it changes from year to year as your pavement conditions change. So what's the impact of this? Obviously, we have some dollars over here. So let's take a look at, from a money point of view, what the more common type of a style is. Your worst first type of a maintenance approach here. You let it deteriorate, and then you do some type of a rehabilitation treatment, and you let it deteriorate. And so while the slide is really busy, what it's showing you is that over time, you wait for it to follow that trigger point, you end up spending over time about $12 per square foot. Taking a critical point management style, you're waiting for that pavement to deteriorate, you do a slurry on it, you do another surface treatment on it, and then you come over here with more of a Cape Seal type treatment, and eventually you're going to have to overlay it. Because remember, it's failing by fatigue as well as environmental distresses. So you got to address the structural deficiencies. And as soon as you do, then you're able to follow that pattern again. By following that pattern over time, you end up spending half as much money on the street. So critical point management has, as not only are you addressing your system, your whole entire system, but it also has a very positive impact in terms of the dollars. You're getting a lot more done for your dollars. And if you take an average line of your pavement through here, your, as far as the conditions go, your pavement conditions are actually in a better condition up here because you're treating it as opposed to waiting for it to get down to that trigger point down below. And then with that, okay.
Over here. So just wanted to give you a brief recap of what you probably already know, which is what have we been doing. So we've been paving by area. So this is just a map of the areas we've got, and there's a lot of advantages to this kind of system. It is predictable. It groups areas so that it's easier to design. It's also more cost effective for a contractor to come into one little area and do their work, or one or two areas. And so what we've been doing is working through on what is somewhat analogous to a worst first approach, because we pick the worst area or two and do those with the available budget. Now, it's not strictly worst first because there's all kinds of different conditions within a different area. Of course, some of them may not be close to their critical point either. So we may be paving some early while we're also catching some at the very bottom. And of course, arterials are more or less treated as an area in here. So budget-wise, what we've been doing is shown in the red line. It spikes up and down because this is showing the total budget, which includes things like grants, which of course we'll continue to hope to get. And we're at a low point down over here on the right because of the, this is our actual expenditures here. And this is where we didn't get bids, and so we didn't spend all of our money. The blue lines are PCI. It started out, and this just is what's in the Street Saver database. So of course things go back further in time, but this is our Street Saver.
What's the green bar?
Well, the green bar is actually the most important bar, because the green bar is the area of pavement that we are managing. So over time, one of the important features to understand of San Ramon is, of course, that we've been growing, and over this time frame, we added, $10 million square feet of pavement.
Okay. Oh, it's a suppress zero on the left.
Yeah,
okay.
It was a suppress zero, so of course we continue to grow before that, and actually there will be some new streets coming online that will add to this.
Okay.
So one of the things that does is this is our PCI line. It's been increasing. We maxed out about 80 last year, dropped down to 78. We're looking at 78 in the future. One of the critical features of all that growth is when you get that new pavement in, it's 100. So all of that development helps gives us
right.
This really nice number. It does another thing. It brings in people. Those people bring in gas tax dollars. So we've been having more gas tax dollars from that growth, but we haven't been spending it on that brand new pavement because you're not going to treat brand new pavement. So we've actually been able to, you know, places like the Doherty Valley in this instance, and other developments, have actually been subsidizing pavement in the San Ramon Valley area. So that's one of the key features that has kept our PCI high. But of course,
it's all going to go to hell at the same time.
You see what's going. This is starts at 2005. We kind of started capping off in here around 2012. So that pavement is aging. And this is just another look at how we've been spending our money. And you see that 75 to 95% of our dollars have been spent on rehabilitation, with 5 to 25% spent on preventative. That 25% is actually an anomaly because it comes
much.
Out of last year where we just did a mix of preventative treatments and the stopgap, or the low PCI treatments.
Right.
So I'm going to turn it over to Daniel.
And I'm going to stand up. I cannot be seated for a long time. Let me just move this table. Some reason it's been
put it right back.
Time.
No.
So you don't want to. You don't
want to. Well, my name is Daniel Chavarria. I started working in San Ramon since last July, so I'm still on probation. And I've been assigned, funny thing, I've been assigned to deliver news here that for some folks it might not be as pleasant. But I think it's a good way to start a conversation, because the way I see this table here, we're in the same team. We're not in different opposite teams, right? And one comment that I just heard that that is, for me, the big challenge is how can we balance what the best or most efficient way to spend our dollars is versus policing our community and actually taking care of low PCI streets more than anything else for safety reasons. And it is a challenge. So let's go very quick, I mean, a summary of what our system is. We have almost 240 centerline miles, that's almost 500 lane miles. We have over 42 million square feet of pavement and over 1,400 street sections. Again, Street Saver, what it does is helping us managing all that information. It's very hard to manage that information without a system as complex as Street Saver is. However, a Street Saver doesn't make the decisions. It's just a tool. Our current system-wide average weighted PCI is 78. I understand back in May, we're talking less than a year ago, we were expecting this PCI to be close to 80 or 80. So that's 2 points below that expectation. But really, when you think about it, when we didn't have any project in 2017, that goes along with the rule of thumb that any street section that is untreated is going to lose 2 or 3 points every year. So if you think about that, just following that logic, well, the entire system, by not receiving any treatment or very few treatment, is going to lose about that too. So 78 is a number that is we can expect that to happen. And the replacement value of all our assets is over 650 million. When we went before, this is just a food for thought. We have spent in the last 13 years, we have spent only twice, a little bit over 1% of that amount in maintenance.
Daniel?
Yes.
One thing to point out is that $653 or $654 million, that's just the street itself. It doesn't include curb, gutter, sidewalks, or the site improvement. That's just the pavement alone. And so when you start adding in all the other parts that have to go with it, it's a sizable asset that you're managing.
So just looking at the system in a more detailed way, dividing information by arterial, collector, residential streets, you can see how the residential streets is almost 60% of all the assets we have, and the type of streets has a PCI, an average PCI of 78, while the arterials and collectors are 79. But based on my experience in other cities, I can tell you, we have a very good system compared to other cities. It might not be the optimum that we want, but it's a good system. But what happens when you have a Ferrari versus a Honda? Well, the maintenance is more expensive. So that's exactly what's going on right now. We have a Ferrari, almost, right? But the maintenance is more expensive than in any other city. So just breaking this down, the PCI, and I'm going to go back to this table later, but I just want to point out how in this range between 71 and 90, we have the majority of our assets. It's about 73, or a little bit over 73% of our assets are in this range. You can see that below 50, we have a little bit over 5%, around 5% here, right? Which is considered for low PCIs, right? And these bars here, and again, I'll go back to this. These bars are the critical point where once you pass this bar, you go to a different cost of maintenance.
Can I go back to that slide, Daniel?
Yeah.
Thanks. So I think that's a really helpful slide, because as I'm trying to integrate this idea of a critical point concept, it seems to me like we're saying, well, residents on their particular street, if they see it in bad shape, so versus your arterials and collectors, which have cumulatively more vehicle miles traveled on them than, let's say, somebody's cul-de-sac or what have you. And I'm kind of thinking, okay, so how do you incorporate for the, I guess it to me would be more important for public safety or whatever, mm-hmm. that we have the arterials and collectors, but yeah, you don't want to neglect the residential, but they are, to me, the most, because they carry the heaviest loads consistently.
Well, for more than a decade, Maria and Mustafa and I have been talking about this, and we collectively set a standard that we never wanted our arterials to get below 50. And if you look on there, the blue bars, you see virtually none below 50, which to me says that that's working pretty good. And then we set the collectors at, what, 45?
45.
And you see there's very little of the red collectors are down in that area either. And then the residential, we set a standard of 35. And once again, we're doing pretty good on that. But to me, keeping those arterials above 50 is absolutely crucial. That's the heavy traffic. That's where all the everybody's traveling, those roads. And we just can't afford to let those
and
go.
Some of those values actually may correspond well with critical point.
It happens to work out pretty well that way.
And in reality, that's how
we fall into something.
What are you doing?
That's how PEI has a addressed this situation in the system. When you compare low PCIs to residential arterials and collectors have a priority. So, I mean, we have a budget. We can only spend this in low PCIs. We're going to spend it in arterials and collectors first, and then in residential.
Right. And I would think that because of the loading, that an arterial will deteriorate much faster, particularly due to the load. It's going to get the same UV everybody else gets, but it has a much higher load. And unless it's constructed differently with a bigger, deeper, heavier base, it will deteriorate much quicker.
Well, on top of that thought, I always think about how many phone calls I'm going to receive in a year.
There you go.
And arterials and collectors definitely are, I mean, more people use them, right?
Sure.
And one more thought before I move to the next slide. Just think about every single year, these bars, if you don't treat them,
right.
These bars shift. Move to the right.
Everything right. Moves to the
little
right.
Little by little, they move to the
and
right.
And then you get to jump them over to the left mm-hmm. once in a while.
So let's talk about the forecast. And hope nobody brought tomatoes or anything to throw. Let me show you here just a graph what the system would be. Without zero funding, right? With zero funding, we just let them go untreated. So we start with a 78, and after 10 years, we will lose almost 20 points in the system. Now let me show you what the same system would do with the projected budget we have, including SB1, using a worst first approach. In other words, focusing on these streets mainly.
Putting virtually all your money down there.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So you can see at the first few years, there's no change, right?
Well, I find that odd because every time you repair a 30 PCI street and it goes to 90, you would think that would... You're adding 70 points to that average would help.
But you're just doing that with 5% of all your assets.
Right.
That's right, because isn't it usually those smaller streets,
right.
The smaller, mm-hmm. what do you call center line miles? Or
in Orinda, right. For example, that the majority of the streets were here, right. Yeah, it's a different situation. Yes, mm-hmm. you bump that up a lot because it's a lot of a lot of area that you're treating.
Takes a lot of money to make the move, though.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So now, if we use the same projected budget, including SB1, by using the critical point management approach,
okay.
We have a different result, a much better result, I would say, right? Compared to this one here. Now, any question? No? Okay. So I just want to point out, go back to this slide, because for us, this is very important. We've been doing this approach of using the majority of our funds in rehabilitation treatments, let's say inlays, overlays, reconstruction, any of those types. I'm not saying that was wrong. I mean, but situation changed, right? Or we have a different scenario now. And what we see now is that it's more efficient at this moment to use our funding more in preventative. And why is that? Because basically, the majority of our assets are in this range that calls for preventative maintenance, right? So
yeah, it's 84% of the roads are in those.
Exactly. And if you see, almost 24% of these are about to jump to the more expensive, for a more expensive treatment. So if we treat them now, we'll be able to contain that. I mean, just imagine how many phone calls we receive here versus how many phone calls we're going to receive here. And this is another way to do it. I always like to bring that up because I'm used to that phone call. So if you see, we're talking about this area, right? We're talking about basically Dory Valley area plus other new streets. maybe 3, 4, 5 years ago, no, maybe, definitely, these bars were on the left side. So they didn't, we didn't need to worry about it. Now, there are some challenges, of course. And before we go there, I just want to mention, though, with the SB1, everybody's aware here that there's an initiative to repeal SB1 in the November ballot. If that happens, this graph we're showing here will change, right? But besides that, we have other challenges. Number one, even with this critical point management approach, with the budget we currently project, the PCI 10-year trend would be that we lower the 78, or we go from 78 to 71. It hasn't incorporated low PCI streets in a manner that we've been doing it. So we're going to pick a few of them. And it has not incorporated contingency streets. What we call contingency streets are streets that maybe they're not low PCI streets, they're maybe not in the critical point, but they're important for other reasons. Maybe a Bollinger Canyon, that we want a time in at the same time of the project we have next door. I mean, other type of situations that are not brought up by the system, but we know, and that we need to make some adjustments. And with that, I'll leave it with you.
Okay, so I wanted to move on to the recommendations. So the recommendations that we're making is to maximize the use of the critical point strategy to get the most out of the life. Again, I want to emphasize that it's maximizing. We recognize that there are those other concerns, both the contingency and the low PCI. But the more we do those, the more we fall off from that optimal green line. But that's the realities that we have to deal with.
I don't disagree with anything that's been said here. However, those streets that are falling off the edge into the world of gravel, we can't have that.
Of course.
So we've got to have a system whereby we maximize through a strategy like this, but we have to keep from dropping below, below 30.
As that, as well as taking into account budget, as well as taking into account overall system. So we have to find a continuous balance between all of those needs.
Mm-hmm.
One of the components would be continue to pave by areas to get the maximum benefit out of contractor mobilization costs.
Right.
However, those wouldn't be the same areas. Instead, we'd be looking at what the critical points are showing us and try to clump areas, make new areas.
So you might take two or three areas and select a dozen streets from them.
Maybe there's a quadrant in the San Ramon Valley area and quadrants out in the Doherty Valley area,
okay. And
you lump them into something like that. Combine the critical point analysis and identifying selected low PCI streets and contingency streets to address those streets that are in the worst condition or special problems. So we recognize that we're going to have to move off that optimal green line that we showed. Talking about changing that low PCI criteria to help with our management from the current 35 to 30.
I might agree to 30, but the problem is when you start getting down below 30, those things turn to rubble pretty quickly, and the phone calls that you don't want to get increase substantially.
Right. On top of that, because of the safety issues that you mentioned, you get an increase in the stopgap needs, because remember, the PCI is just an average for the street, but one little spot may be really, really bad and need patching.
Right.
Undertake an extensive preventative maintenance program on newer street sites, predominantly the Doherty Valley area, that are approaching the critical point at which the low point preventative maintenance will no longer be. So this is really just picking up on what was proposed a few years back of doing a preventative maintenance program, primarily focused on the Doherty Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And picking up those streets before they start falling off that edge.
Mm-hmm.
Robin, on that point, that's fine. So you've been doing it by geographical area, which would tell me that the most recent geographical areas are going to have the highest PCI.
Uh-huh.
And so You have that as a roadmap for this critical point methodology, I think, to guide you to where the work is going to be, it seems right, because you're going to go, well, we haven't done this geographical area in 3 years. We're going to look.
That and the PCI, we have all of that mapped out, so right. It's all on the GIS system, and we know where various PCIs are, and we break it into areas.
Okay.
Implement a refuse vehicle impact fee. This fee could result in an addition of $1.5 million annually. That's a schedule for discussion with the Finance Committee, but I did want to give a brief discussion more on that in a moment. Other little tweaks that you may see happening is we might end up getting separate bids for asphalt concrete work as opposed to the preventative work. That way we're not paying markups on subs. The subs aren't tripping over each other, and we can schedule work separately. Minimize concrete work that's done as a subcontractor working to the paving contractors. When you're doing this work, of course, we want to get the curb and gutter fixed before we do the pavement. We're also mandated by law to fix ADA ramps under certain circumstances. We find that it's likely substantially more cost-effective to pull that work out of the pavement management program if you can, and increase the funding for the sidewalk. So instead of paying for it under one CIP, we pay for it under a different CIP. Same dollars, but we hope to save money and be more cost-effective doing it that way. Move streets previously done with the stopgap program into the pavement management project as contingency streets. In past practice, occasionally whole street sections have shown up under the stopgap to be done. Ideally, we would roll those in with the pavement management program so we get a better bid for it. That would reduce the amount of money that we put in stopgap, and that money would be moved into pavement management. That would then perhaps change the kind of contractors who are attracted to our stopgap. Right now, we're not very happy with our current one because it's too small to work for them. That ties in with improving coordination with public services and engineering so that maybe we're doing more of that stopgap work in-house. Evaluate pavement technologies that are not...
Can I stop you on that? So, like, you guys can actually do that in public services, some of the stopgap work?
Yes, we can. Patrick is actually our program manager for streets.
This would mainly be crack sealing, small potholes, the kind of thing that contractors are hesitant to come out for, so we can do the work and think we can do it cheaper, and we can certainly be much more responsive. So we still have a stopgap contractor, but we're looking at shifting dollars around a little bit.
Not only cheaper, but faster.
Faster, yes.
And
what's that done with, like a cold mix something?
No, well, it depends. It may mean some places it's using better cold mixes depending on when we know we're going to pave it. It can tie us over. Mm-hmm. It might be hot mix. It's also the crack sealing operations.
Okay.
Evaluate pavement technologies that have not been used in the city. Determine if they can be better solutions.
Sure.
There's things that other cities are using that we haven't used. Maybe they would work here. They might come with drawbacks, but it's worth discussing. We'd come back maybe and discuss those with you, or at least give you a heads up that we're doing something different. Evaluate other aspects of the program to further reduce costs. Do things like consider flexibility in working hours and duration of the contracts. That's a relatively minor issue, but it does come up where if we're reducing work hours in a residential area, contractors paying prevailing wage for an 8-hour day, we're limiting it to 6 hours. That hurts our budget.
That's always going to be a problem when you got families that have to get out of their driveway to get a kid to school.
Yep.
And you can't say, I'm sorry, you're going to have to wait 15 minutes to get out of the driveway. That doesn't work. That really doesn't.
Well,
but what it could work is that we develop a better way to communicate that with the community ahead of time, and they plan to leave 50 minutes earlier. The problem is, right now it's a contractor's market. I mean,
yeah.
And there's nothing that we can do about it. We don't have control. And when we are happy to receive SB1 money, but other cities are receiving SB1 money too.
Yeah.
And other cities,
you better not leave your cell phone at home.
Yep. Well, that is a notable part of the problem.
Yeah.
However, if we limit a, in a school area, if we limit the work hours to six,
I don't disagree that it causes problems. Like I just said, you don't want to leave your cell phone at home.
Yes.
You will get the calls and...
So if you want to...
And it's also a timing factor, too. If we can get the schoolwork, which we've always tried to do, is do it during the summer, get it out of the way.
But if I live on a cul-de-sac, and you're paving the whole cul-de-sac, and you say, okay, you know, it's 8 o'clock, and we're paving, and you just walk out to your car, and school starts at 8:12, and you're 8:15...
So,
but there are things that we're doing about that. Let me just give you an example. A contractor, we will plan a paving contract, right, during the summer. But the contractor starts with concrete work first. So half or a month into the contract, they're just doing concrete work. So by the time they start, there's a bunch of streets that are left to be done after school begins again. So what we're doing right now is starting the concrete work now, that it doesn't affect the public that much or the traffic. So when summer hits or the school is out...
You don't have to convince me. You really don't. Yeah. It's when that person goes out to their car and there's a paving machine at the end of their driveway.
You just got to be prepared. Exactly, you got to be prepared. What you're talking about.
Prepare the town now, not the city. They
I know, but they're going to call.
Yep.
Yes, they will.
They will call. I guarantee it. They will call.
Yeah.
An anecdote on that, the city of Oakland paved Skyline Boulevard near my house 4 years ago now, and they were doing a grind operation right across the entrance to Skyline High School at 8 in the morning. So, yeah, we don't want to be like them, and we won't be like them,
right?
But we need to give some thought to that.
Right.
And I thought I had a graph here. I don't have it. But just let me mention.
You guys did my street 2 years ago.
Yes, 26.
And people were really good about notifying that on that day you were going to be, and if you didn't, you wanted to have your car out of your driveway and around the corner. And it was real nice because the church next door said, you guys can park over here in the church. And so a lot of people did. They parked in the church lot. Mm-hmm. So they walked over that day. But there may be a couple of people who just don't get it.
That same year, we had issues. We dealt with the issues. And because we put our phone numbers on the flyers, then we didn't. We had issues. We had complaints. But we were able to take care of them.
Right.
So we will have complaints. We will have issues. But we don't have a problem with dealing with them.
You have social media and you have Nextdoor now, which you didn't necessarily have 24 months ago. And I think that's going to go
but
a long
out of me,
way for them.
My neighborhood, there's 106 homes. And I looked on the map for next door.
Right, right.
Out of the 106 homes, there's about 80 of them that are on next door. But it's the other 26 that are going to call you.
But I had phone calls. People had surgery that day. Yeah. We had the contractor giving people rides out from the top of the cul-de-sac. We have there's a daycare up there. We were working with the daycare. So really, the people work with us, and as long as they have a phone number,
they want to see the street get done.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what they're looking at. Their tax dollars at work. They're going to try to help it.
Yep. So next steps, we can take, incorporate, of course, all your comments, go to the city council if that's what you want to do with this presentation. We're going to present the refuse vehicle impact fee to the finance committee. Just for your information on that, if that goes through, we could anticipate that we'd have sufficient funds that we could more readily take care of low PCI streets on basically the five-year program that we basically already uses our standard, and while at the same time getting onto a better curb with our PCI and raising that up a couple of points. So
along those lines, I've identified some slides that I would like you to take to the finance committee. Not that I've seen them, but I want Phil to see them. And so if Harry's seen them, I've seen them, and Phil's seen them, we're a long way down that path. And what I'd like to see is you take this graph here that is the one that uses critical point management and includes the SB1 money.
Uh-huh.
And I'd like you to create a new one that includes the vehicle, the refuse vehicle impact fee.
Got it. Unfortunately, it fell off this presentation.
Okay. So what would the graph look like if we had that RVIF on that curve, what would that look like?
Okay.
Because that could be a very compelling moment in our discussions on the garbage contract.
So
do you have that? Do you have that graph?
Yeah, we'll pull it up.
We do. We'll pull it up.
Okay.
So what we'd like to do next is proceed with the critical point management approach and prepare a list of candidate streets as we always do, come back in March with a five-year plan that incorporates that critical management approach to the best of our ability while accommodating PCIs to the best of our ability. That'll, of course, be heavily influenced on what kind of feedback we get on the refuse of vehicle impact fee. And then see where we go from there.
Yeah, that money won't be available until the end of 2019, though, right? With the new contract.
It does not have to be linked to the new contract. But that's a factor that can be decided upon. And then there's another thing that we already started talking about.
We can implement it now.
We could.
Ooh. Okay. I think it'd be easier to implement with the new contract, but yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
The old system was, in some ways, easier to explain to people.
Mm-hmm.
We recognize that.
Mm-hmm.
There are also a lot of things that may come along with various elements we've talked about that require more explanation. So I think one of the important things that we need to be doing as staff is preparing information for the public. So we really want to, now that we've got a new web system up, enhance the information that we have on there, perhaps change the way we present information to the public as we go into the contract, just in general, do a lot more work preparing for the information for the public. So,
Well, Susie, you guys did a really great job when they paved my neighborhood. I thought that things went well. I don't want to discount that at all. And they were very responsive. But as you know, out of every 100 homes, there's going to be two or three that no matter what you do, you hang something on their door, you grind their street in front of their house, and they still don't get it. So.
But I think it's important to still communicate with them. I had some people, they were very upset. But by the end of it, they understood. They understood that I'm doing my best, but I'm dealing with a contractor who I can't drag him out of. I can't drag him from his office down.
Right.
I'm doing the best I can.
Okay.
You know.
So, of course, we're not supposed to talk about this too much because it's going to the other committee. But just as a preview, this is the slide that we'll be showing.
Okay.
And we would anticipate that we get a couple point bumps while being able to deal with those other issues.
The last thing I'd like to see then on this is how much money does it take to maintain a 78? You know, somewhere between 78 and 80, how much money does that take?
Well,
and I know that's a big pile of money, but obviously $1 million a year doesn't pull it all the way up.
Answer the question with a graph right now. Just to explain a little bit about this one.
Right.
This graph here is $1 million.
Right. I read that.
And $500,000 dedicated to low PCI streets.
Okay.
Every year. If we would like to get let's say 280 on top of the refuse fee, $1.5 million, we would need about $2 million per year.
On top of
I thought we were putting a million and a half. You know, we had a line from Mustafa that said, here's what $1.5 million does. And $1.5 million kept us at 80 at one
time. Yes.
It did.
So.
But remember, things have shifted.
Yeah.
No.
Deteriorating, so.
Well, no, they Mustafa had the PCI and the aged PCI and the fact that, you know, streets decay. So, there you go. So it still takes another million and a half. 1.7 million.
And he also didn't do the projections out 10 years. We would always do it for five years.
It's still.
The factors that have been changing also is that price is going up, so then that gets rolled into our projections and carries things out. Also, as the one of the things the database does is curve fit. So it's always figuring out what's the newest curve. And you'll get new curves applied to those Doherty Valley pavements as they begin to age and pull off that flat line.
Oh, yeah.
That curve fitting alone can major do some major changes to your projection.
Is the MRP 2.0 stuff factored into this, the whole when you do pavement management, you've got to do bio. I read that in one of the reports, like you got to start dealing with bio retention.
There are no special costs associated with compliance with green infrastructure built into this.
Okay.
But the curb ramps are, and as Joe could explain better, in 2014 there was a major change in terms of curb ramps, and now we build more curb ramps than before.
About 25% of the budget is going to curb ramps now. And that's a mandate that they used to say at FHWA and the DOJ and all the people who kind of oversee the ADA compliance rules said, if you do a maintenance project on your street, then you need to address and upgrade your ramps to the current standards. And so what everyone was doing is saying, this is just a maintenance project, even though they might be reconstructing the street. And so finally, DOJ came out and said, stop that, we're gonna define what treatments trigger a ramp. And so they said, a slurry seal does not trigger a ramp. A cape seal, or a chip seal will not, but a cape seal will trigger a ramp. Overlays trigger ramps. And so they have all of these different things now that define when you have to address the ramp upgrades.
So that's, let me just, if I could carry just
for
a minute.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that results in the cost increase that affects what we can do. But it's also one of those things that is going to affect the treatments that we do. We started doing a lot of microsurface. Microsurface, for some reason, got on that list of what triggers ramps. And since it's not a hugely different treatment from a slurry, we're likely to see a lot more slurries and less microsurface, except where maybe we're on an arterial, and it's really, you get the better benefit for that microsurface, and it makes it worthwhile.
And somewhere in another future meeting for either this committee or somewhere else, let us know how much more ramp work we still have to do in the city. How much, if there are, 8,027 locations that need ramps and we've finished 3,812 of them, what is it? How far are we into, yes, sir?
I wish that could be defined. Here's the problem, is different committees, there's three of them, there's PROAG and even Caltrans weighs in on this too. And as soon as one of them says, we need to adjust what we think a compliant ramp is, then suddenly all the rules change.
Oh, I understand. Okay, you're going to have to take a snapshot in time. What is the standard today? When we build a road, when we fix a road, what is the standard we're going to make that ramp to? And granted, there may be 1,000 ramps that we fixed 5 years ago that are no longer compliant. Understand?
Exactly.
And they would be part of the database that says that we need to bring them up to
some. Patrick and I were talking about this afternoon, and that's actually one of the things we could do. One of our contractors not only does repairs to the ramps and concrete in an effective way, but they also GPS locate and do an evaluation of all the ramps. So one thing we can do is maybe advance some of the money from the maintenance and put it into an inventory that would give us a snapshot.
Put it in the
where
GIS.
Where it stands now, it's in the GIS system. We then coordinate it with our pavement management and know what we need to do and what we don't.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be a rare item in the Doherty Valley. One of the
outside,
they're mostly compliant, but the cost will be a lot lower.
Newer developments should be mostly compliant, so you're probably looking at the older geographical.
Yeah.
There were three things that, when I read this report, that I just wanted to make mention of. To the extent that you can, to prioritize school zones, because that's heavy traffic in your critical point analysis. Roadway striping to me is a big deal, just as a driver. And so if I'm on whatever the PCI of the road is, okay, whatever, I'm a driver, I don't know what the PCI of the road is, but I mean, unless it's all pothole and stuff, but if the striping is not good, and are there opportunities to stripe almost as a preventative, you know. And so I put that out there because I do think striping is very critical as it washes away and it, you know, the paint and what new opportunities in materials are there to get longer lasting striping. And then this heavy use material, so you mentioned asphalt and concrete, and so I'm wondering if there are, if you have to do a pretty good construction project, like let's say Bollinger, and you say, well, asphalt is the traditional and it costs X, but this costs more, but we know it lasts way longer, or it has there's a cost benefit to that. Can we start incorporating that into some of these arterials or some of these areas where we know we're, you know, if we're going to start getting money for potentially the refuse vehicles, right? Mm-hmm. Can we put money to get a better surface that's going to last us longer? And does that extrapolate out when it comes to looking at the dollars and the value to that? I'm interested in. What are the technologies of today in terms of new materials, where can we use them?
Is it okay to talk about a couple of things?
And I think maybe what you're thinking of in part is like concrete versus asphalt.
What rubber? Yeah. I don't know. I mean,
there's a lot of factors. But go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, it's interesting. California is experimenting a lot with how can we make our pavements last longer. Part of the design criteria, though, the very basic part of it is you do a life cycle cost analysis. You pick your treatment, you pick your design, and this usually happens in the design phase of the project. We've got our streets picked, and now we're going to get the most out of the streets through design and through value engineering. And part of that is looking at the life cycle cost analysis. It's going to cost this much, this many years, divide the two, and you get this much per year, and it's cheaper to go this option versus that option. It might be more expensive initially. And we're seeing, actually, one that you might recognize that is like In-N-Out Burgers. You know, you go to their old places, they're all asphalt parking lots. You go to their newer ones, they're concrete. As they found that maintenance and ease of just everything, and then how long it lasts is mattering. So people are catching on to that. The other thing that's happening is Caltrans is working on long life pavements. So asphalt is designed and will deteriorate at 20 years environmentally. And so you've got to somehow be able to treat that. I mean, you can over design it for the truckloads, but it's still going to deteriorate environmentally. So they've actually have five projects throughout the state that they're monitoring. They've already built them and now they're monitoring to see if how long they're lasting and if their projections are looking right. And it's a layered system where they bring in very oily mix down at the bottom and then less oily, and then they're working up to a sacrificial surface course is what they're looking at. So
you mentioned the In-N-Out Burger thing. In-N-Out Burger, when they had that place paved, they're planning on staying there a long time. So
absolutely.
They when they hired a contractor to come in, they specified, when we have a developer, you know, D.R. Horton or you know, Cal Atlantic Homes, they're going to pave it and leave. Mm-hmm. And so they're interested in getting the lowest cost, not life cycle cost, but the lowest cost moving, you know, so that they meet our minimum requirements and they're out of here.
So,
and they'll be out of here in 4 or 5 years before they've fallen off that curve.
So for you.
But in Germany, interesting, I want to finish this. In Germany, when they built the Autobahns, it comes with a multi-year maintenance contract. So when they
yes.
pave it, that company that paved it is responsible for maintaining it. So they have a lot of concrete Autobahns out there with not just 4 inches of concrete or 6 inches. They may have as much as 8 inches of concrete, and it stays smooth and hard and solid for decades.
Well, there are two factors there. I mean, when you're considering replacing the type of surface, right? For example, concrete. You're not going to do that in a preventative candidate roadway. You're going to do that in a reconstruction one. You're going to, okay, that makes sense to take into account this analysis. But the other factor is what everybody is concerned about is public disruption. Right? If we're going to build a concrete roadway, it brings other challenges that it's slower, maybe. Is it going to create more detours than an FDR, for example? I mean, a full depth reclamation is one treatment that has been used lately in our state and very efficiently, and it's very fast to apply. So you not only compare the cost, but also the construction, the duration of the construction, and the disruption to the public.
I guess looking ahead, and you know where your projects are going to be coming in the future. I mean, you have this one right now with City Center and that Bishop Drive going into that, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe, I don't know, you're probably too late in the game, but you have Crow Canyon widening or these type of things where you know you're going to get into that. Maybe that's an opportunity. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I might be playing with my probation here, but I think
you're earning your keep.
I have worked in three different public agencies, right, and specifically with pavement. San Francisco, of course, is a big agency, but they had a specific public relationship, a public relation office. Any paving contract, this guy know what to say, how to say it, how to talk, when to do it, which vehicles to use to communicate with the public. I know nowadays we have many ways to communicate with the public, but that doesn't mean that an engineer suddenly has become a great communicator, right? In that his only function is just to communicate with the public. It can be done, but it takes a longer time to prepare for that, which usually we don't have. So the only thought that I want to leave is, well, we might be able just to take a few dollars of our pavement program and hire a consultant that knows what they do and save us time, that we can develop a strategy to reach the public, a video, 2-minute video of this presentation, 3-minute video that explains the critical point approach. Why are we doing this? That is concise, it's professional people, the people who knows how to reach to the public can help us doing it. And we put in YouTube, we put in all the media we have, and I guarantee you we're going to receive less phone calls. And people will be willing, at least, to hear more about us. It's not like, sometimes I feel, and it's not, I'm not talking about San Ramon, but my experience in the public sector, that is the public against us. And it shouldn't be that way, right? So just a thought.
Isn't that top secret double probation over here? You got these people walking around on needles. No, that's an excellent point. Communicating with the public, I think it's well worth it.
There are very few opportunities that of communication that don't make sense. That it's almost always the case that more communication helps when people understand what it is that you're dealing with and how we can make their life better in the long run. It almost always helps. Almost always. I think we need to move forward with this. I'd be happy to talk with you more about how to present this to the whole council, but there's pieces of this I'd like to see come to the Finance Committee, and I've identified those pages. And I'll show you which ones I think need to come to the Finance Committee. But I think that it clearly makes sense to go with this. This
very good work.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Critical point management approach.
It makes a lot of sense given where we are. And we're almost at build out. I mean, besides Doherty Valley, it's infill development.
Right.
And maybe that begs the question for the planning department to the point about, well, they only want to put down this and then they bail. The metrics are higher or the metrics are changed, and those are internal discussions you guys can have. You know, hey, so what about that, right? What about what we ask these developers? I mean, how we're getting roadways. We may be past that game because the projects aren't going to be as big. But
yeah, it'd been nice for you.
Yeah, we need to do about 20 years, 10 years. No, but this is excellent. This is very good.
And one thing I'll point out is this is kind of a hybrid system. You've got so much of your system that is ready to fall off from that category good into down, that this will look like the first couple of years, the pavement management program will look like a best first type of an approach.
Right.
But it will transition into a critical point management as we get a handle on all of those pavements,
right.
Put them behind us,
yes.
and preserve them, and then move forward. So it's going to be a transition type
you'll,
of a plan.
You will see much more frequent change in the next 10 years than you ever saw in the last 20.
Mm-hmm. It's excellent. I think this is really going to be a public benefit coming forward. It's a very good thing.
Are we through with this agenda item? Anything else you guys need from us, Robin? Or
no, I don't think so.
Okay.
Comments.
Committee member comments? Great first meeting.
Great first meeting. We kept it to
good.
Reasonable time.
All right. Well, you kind of tell us when you think we need to have the next meeting. I mean, we talked about 4 to 6 a year, and you'll have to tell us when. This is kind of the season. These next 6 months are kind of the season for having them more often, and then the following 6 months are when we have fewer of them. So we may have.
Do you have any topics that you'd like to see? I'd kind of like to have a discussion on the Iron Horse stuff. If you want to come to us in the future, I mean, we can always talk about topics, but do you have any stuff that do you think?
Well, the CIP is going to be coming up soon. And the CIP elements that are
germane to
this committee, yeah, the infrastructure, you know, the, whether it's
storm.
Traffic lights or storm, you know, whatever it is, those infrastructure things, I'm sure we'll have one of those meetings.
I think probably one of the more important ones is the infrastructure maintenance fund,
right.
Because we're in the middle of updating all the replacement plans,
right.
And so that will change all of the numbers and see where we are with the balance. So we're planning to bring that forward next month,
okay.
As well as the 5-year pavement repair
full
plan.
March.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Do Fridays work?
Friday's fine with me. Yeah.
Well, then I would recommend Fridays would be, if you're going to do Fridays, I have staff that I don't want to send home on a Friday night at 5:30. So if you can make it as, if we can, because you guys, this is really great stuff, but I want to be sensitive to the workload of the staff that's existing. So if we can, if you can make it at 3:30, is that, this what we started at 4, right? So would that work all right? Can you get there in time, Harry? Is that enough?
You got to ask traffic on the snow grade if I can make it on time.
I know that's.
I will set it at 3:30 and start the meeting if I'm not here. That's fine.
Hmm?
I won't tell anybody.
Well, I'm okay with 3:30.
Yeah.
I mean, unless you think hour meetings are.
I think 3:30 can be fine. I mean, it's manageable for sure.
Are there any other dates? I'm not sure if this was just because it was the first one we're trying to get it in.
The days that work the best are Monday, Tuesday, and Friday.
Okay.
Afternoons.
Mondays are generally good. That's fine. You can do a doodle.
The only problem, that's when my finance committee meeting is, so we just have to make sure we're not on the same day as the finance committee meeting. But Mondays, Tuesdays, and Fridays are best for me.
All right. Any
time after 3:15.
As well?
Monday, Tuesdays, and Fridays generally.
Okay.
Yeah, any time after 3:15.
That's a
Okay. 3:15.
Yep.
3:30.
Yeah,
3:30.
Best for
magic time.
Okay.
Just, we got to make sure. I have TVTC. They sometimes meet on Mondays.
Yeah.
And so
Mondays is usually pretty impacted.
I know. So we'll find a way.
Okay.
Okay. Let's adjourn. All right. What I did. And you guys have to decide how you want to connect these things, but the slides I thought that were particularly valuable. I put a star.